into, let's say, drilling in that unit have been trained has been by the charge hands under whom the operator is working.
How's that happened? Because that's a very different system of training.
Yes and no. Because really all you're saying in either approach is that you have got someone who is the training guru who will impart the training skills. And in the operator training schools where we actually have the areas set aside, it's not exclusively done in those areas. Usually the first bits of the jobs or the first bits of the training are done in those areas, but as soon as possible the operators are transferred to the live environment.
Yes.
And then you have instructors who keep a BDI on those people on the job in situ. And then it really is not very different from having charge hands who, as part of their functions, train new operatives into their areas.
Yes. Right.
And really, if you are, for example, taking someone on who's doing a drilling job, it's not a very sophisticated set of skills that you're trying to impart. You've got to be able to switch the drill on and off, and you've got to be able to read prints, you've got to decide what sort of drill to put in the machine, you've got to know how to sharpen your drill, and so on. But that isn't too difficult to impart. It's more difficult, interestingly enough, to actually recruit people who can read prints or can even read a rule. In my days, when I was a foreman, something like 10 years ago, you'd find that a very high proportion of applicants didn't know how many eighths of an inch there were in an inch, for example.
Mm.
You know, very simple type questions that they just couldn't cope with. But once one has got someone who has got the essential ability to read prints or to perform the manual skills required, then someone has to impart those skills.
Right.
And in some cases, in most cases in fact, it's an instructor. In other cases, it's a charge hand.
Yes. So there isn't a great difference.
That's right. It's no different from taking on a clerk typist, let's say, and looking after probably her in the job and just showing her day by day all the new things that, all the new tricks that have to be learned.
Which is primarily what happens for clerk typists.
That's right.
Yes, so to go back to the previous example we were talking about.
Because few jobs are identical, they all tend to be different.
Right.
So the only place you can learn that is by actually going through the system a few times, week by week.
What about retraining? I mean, are you having to... We've talked about... To stick with operatives for a minute. We've talked to operators. We've talked about people coming in and getting either a smaller or a larger amount of training and then some further training on the job.
Mm-hmm.
In what circumstances do you retrain people? I mean, does it have to do with people wanting to get their speeds up, or does it have to do with actually changing technology, or
and who operator
decides?
Areas,
yes.
It's predominantly because new technologies or new equipment are coming in, and we obviously then need to get the operators assembling those new type products as quickly and as effectively as possible.
Indeed, yes.
But you do occasionally find an instance where an operator is simply not performing up to scratch, and then in many cases that operator is brought back into the training school and retrained. And at the end of the day, if that operator still doesn't make the grade, then it may be a matter of waving goodbye. But that's a relatively small proportion of the retraining category.
And in that small instance, would that be because somebody that's supervising her has decided that, or is it because she feels she's lost her speeds and wants to come back and pick them up again?
On the whole, it's because the supervisor would decide that she, or in many cases it's he, it's predominantly she in the operator areas, is not producing up to a minimum acceptable level.
And
because
those
for any particular job,
are...
there are specified acceptable levels, and if an operator does not meet that level, then some sort of action is normally taken.
Yes.
Say either to retrain or transfer to another job, or in some instances to say goodbye. Obviously,
yes.
Going through the usual warning system,
yes.
So it doesn't come as a bolt out of the blue to the individual that she's not producing the goods.
And what about retraining because of new technology? I mean, does this mean you're having to do a lot of and spend a lot of money on retraining at the moment?
Yes, a fair amount of money has to be spent because there are a lot of new products coming in.
Mm. So does that mean that is it that at certain points then you have a massive amount of retraining because of some really drastic technological shift, or is it really a kind of ongoing process of...
On the whole, it's more evolutionary than revolutionary.
Yes.
The change tends to be rather spread out.
And that would have effects on the training programs?
Yes, it means that we can maintain a reasonable core of instructors, because it does take a long time to train the instructor. So what you find is,
yes,
that in various parts of the company, when work is a bit low, the instructors cross-train each other to improve their flexibility.
Oh.
That has happened in a number of areas as an alternative to making instructors redundant, knowing that there was a reasonable chance that business would pick up again, and then A, would have your instructors still around to cope with the expansion of the business, and secondly, you would have a more flexible group of instructors.
Yes. Do you have statistics on the number of men and women instructors you have for?
Unfortunately, I don't have them offhand. But, you know, for a factory like Spond Street, there may be 3 or 4 instructors.
Yes.
For a factory like Kellam Street, which employs about 1,500 people, I think it is, maybe 2,000, there's more like a dozen to 15,
yes,
instructors.
That's at all levels?
Operator training.
Yes.
What other levels were you thinking of? Or were you thinking of levels within
I'm thinking primarily of operator training. I know you said before that they'd mainly be women because they'd be recruited from the shop floor.
That's right.
How do you decide to... that somebody wants to train somebody to be an instructor?
Obviously, first of all, they've got to have the dexterity skills. They've got to be significantly above average so that they can impart them. And then it's a matter of seeing whether their personality is likely to be such that they are going to have a degree of empathy with new employees.
So would you select people, or people apply, or you decide that there are so many jobs and... people apply, or...?
Well, when there are vacancies, which isn't all that often,
no,
on the whole, the instructors tend to be a fairly stable part of the labour force, then, you know, it's generally made known that the vacancy is there. It could be that individuals are approached.
So it's not formally advertised, but it's...
Oh, yes, there are notice boards around the company.
Mm.
Unfortunately, not many people read notice boards, and they tend, you know, in the company with as much information to impart as we have, there's all sorts of stuff that gets stuck on the notice board. So it's more usually that it's by word of mouth that people pick it up, although there's no attempt on the company's part to conceal the information. But
so it would be put on
the
notice board.
It would certainly be put on the notice board.
But that's
right.
Not the way in which people would know.
In practice, it's far more likely that people would get to know that the vacancy was there simply by word of mouth, and because you know, the operator training areas, by definition, are well immersed in the area, so they're, you know, constantly talking,
yes,
to the foreman and operators,
yes,
and they know them all well day to day.
And people would be selected by the instructor in that area, would they?
The operator training officer would make the appointment.
Yes, I see. And then that's an appointment for all time. I mean, they
Yes.
They don't,
unless there's no guarantee that they wouldn't be made redundant or wouldn't be pushed out because they didn't make the grade. But, like any
appointment
in a company, it's usually a promotion and people then get stuck into it.
Yes. Well, I know that within GEC, you have very few part-time workers, not relatively speaking. I mean, do part-timers get trained in the same ways? Or
Oh, yes.
On both the evening shift and the day shift?
Oh, yes. We, particularly in operator areas, would be most unlikely to bring someone in and put them into a production job without prior training.
So does that mean that, for example, on the evening shift, you'd have a training system working at those hours?
To be honest, I'm not sure. I think we have very few evening shifts
around. You don't have many, no.
And it's a few years now since we used to have them. I just don't know whether in those days we used to have an operator, trainer, or operator instructor on the evening shift, or whether they came in on day shift and then transferred the evenings.
Right. And what about part-timers on the day shift, which you don't have very many of, I know. I mean, do they be trained in the same ways?
Yes.
And would they ever become training instructors, for example? Or
they could do. But obviously, if they're only part-timers, it would be unlikely that we'd want to take them on as instructors.
Yeah.
It tends to be a full-time job.
Yeah, so basically they would remain operators. But I mean, that's a kind of dying area within the company, really, isn't it?
Yes, that's not a vast amount of turnover in operator areas, simply because I guess there aren't that many jobs outside.
Right.
Anyway. And I don't think that people are that dissatisfied with their lot, without suggesting we don't have IR problems. But most of the IR problems that we have are on the Stoke site.
Why is that, do you think?
I think it's because it's such a large site and people lack identity.
Mm.
And people doing more or less identical jobs in other factories, including within Coventry, don't have anything like the IR problem. But I think that people need to identify with their workplace, and they can do it at a place like Swan Street, and they can do it at a place like Helen Street, and they can do it at a place like Ford Street.
So it's a feature of size,
where,
really?
On the Stoke site, where there's about 8,000 people, somehow I think that people lose their sense of identity as part of the reason. Maybe it can't be all of it.
Yes. Well, because it's so much bigger.
But on the whole, the turnover is relatively low. And I'm sure that that's a reflection, amongst other things, of the employment situation in Coventry.
Yes, absolutely. And since you still employ quite a lot of women, I mean, particularly the employment situation for women in the manufacturing industry has never been very good.
Right.
Certainly. Can you tell me something about the work experience schemes you've run? Are you responsible for them?
Yes, in the sense that one of my six senior training officers, a guy called Frank Bush, is very much the brains behind it. And first work experience scheme was something like 4 years ago, I think. And that was before I became controller of training.
Were you here before that?
Yes,
in a different
job?
I
was one of the senior trainees before coming into this. And Frank Bush really got very switched on to the work experience scheme and has done a sterling job in persuading lots of supervisors and managers around the place to take a lot of these people and draw up detailed training schemes. And at the end of it, to take most of them on. Frank Bush will sweat blood and tears if he has to, in order to persuade a manager to take on someone from the work experience scheme. And he has a very good relationship with the local work experience MSC organisers.
Mm.
And we take on the order of about 40 to 45 a year, usually about 35 or so of them in one big intake in October or thereabouts, and the others coming in ones and twos as openings come up. We always try to make sure that in those instances we feel that there is a reasonable chance that there will be a vacancy either in that area or in a similar area.
So you don't. So you do it very much when you think there are going to be vacancies,
That's right.
They can be taken on if they're all right for permanent employment.
That's right. I mean, the thing is a sort of mutual back scratching exercise in that there's lots of managers who know that if they've got a short term problem, there's a fair chance if they yell to Frank Bush, he is going to successfully yell to the Manpower Services Commission and get a work experience individual in to do that job. But wherever we possibly can, we try to make sure that that individual then ends up with a job at the end of the 6 months.
Yes, right. Even though it may not be in that...
Might not be in that area.
In that area.
But might be in another area that's similar. Could be quite different. We try to play the game, so to speak, so that we are not misusing the system. And it...
Is that an assumption of the MSC programmes, that you should try and take people on afterwards, or not necessarily?
Yes, I think it is a gentleman's agreement, if you'll excuse the male chauvinist.
I'm sure that's what it is, yes.
Are only taking people on with the intention that wherever possible we will employ them at the end, rather than simply using them as cheap labour.
Yes.
And
cheap labour for the duration of the scheme.
That's right. And the way that Frank Bush looks at it is that it's a 6 month interview. If they don't fit into one area, he tries to slot them into another. But it is becoming increasingly difficult to find jobs for them, because the usual areas that they go into are clerical and operative, and there simply aren't that many vacancies around. So, it is becoming increasingly more difficult, but we're still relatively successful in finding jobs for them. And it's something that I think we would intend to continue with. I think that a large company like GEC Telecoms has a responsibility anyway to the local community, in a sense. And particularly to young people who are unemployed. And somehow we seem to have got ourselves a good name with the Manpower Services Commission. I think that there don't seem to be many large companies who have got into work experience in quite the positive sort of way that Frank Bush has. And the Manpower Services Commission always seem to quote GEC and Marks and Spencers as the two big companies that have got into work experience, and tend to be rather rude about most other large companies. And certainly I think that in GEC, the GEC Telecom scheme is almost certainly the biggest, and I've an idea that the GEC Telecom scheme is about the biggest in the country anyway, which is probably a poor reflection on everyone else rather than a brilliantly good reflection on ourselves. It is possible to do it if you've got someone who will put their backs into it and is motivated and can get everyone involved in it.
Yes.
But the majority of those people are in fact girls. There's more girls than boys.
Do you know what the statistics are on that?
I can find them out, but I would guess on the whole that it's about 2/3 girls to 1/3 boys.
Is that because of the nature of the jobs that they go into?
Yes, because in clerical, they're predominantly going to clerical areas, a few of them into operator areas, and an even smaller number going into technical areas. So it's usually the boys.
How would that break down?
Say, let's supposing we had about 35 people coming in, I would think that 20 would probably go into clerical areas, 10 might go into operator areas, and 5 might go into technical areas.
Yes. So that means that, does that mean that, for example, you would automatically recruit mainly girls because you don't, I mean, clerical work's a...
Well, what we do is we start off, before we go to the Manpower Service Commission and say we want to recruit so many people, Frank Bush goes around to all the areas that he thinks he can possibly think of who might train a work experience kid and says how many can you take and what would they be doing.
Mm.
He then provides a list to the Manpower Services Commission of the areas and the numbers. The Manpower Services Commission then advertise it both directly to people who are on their books and through Job Hunter, which you're probably aware of here. And then on the due dates, Frank Bush and myself and one or two others perhaps go along to the Career Centre and interview all the applicants and try and match them with the vacancies for training that we have got. And on the whole, we know that the vacancies that we have got for training are reasonably likely to end up as vacancies for employment if the individuals show promise.
So if you're looking, if you've got vacancies in an operator area that's predominantly female or a clerical area that's, well, that all of which would be predominantly female, then you'd interview girls for that?
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
So you wouldn't get a kind of mismatch?
But that's it. I mean, it's always difficult to look 6 months ahead. But there's nothing to stop an individual going into a vacancy before the 6 months is up.
Yes.
And of course they can go into vacancies in other companies. There's no block whatsoever on them to discourage them in any way from applying for other jobs elsewhere during the scheme. Mm. On the whole, they stay with us for the full 6 months and then they slot into various vacancies. No, in a number of cases they slot into vacancies full-time in the company before the 6 months are up.
Yes. And do they get special training while they're on these 6 months, 6 month schemes, or do they get the same training that anybody else would get?
No, they get different training. First of all, they are under the overall guidance of Frank Bush and his Girl Friday called Jane Bennett.
Yes.
And Jane is actually an ex-teacher, so she organises sessions on such things as how to read pay packets and how to fill in job application forms, and a bit of mathematics and such like. One of Frank Bush's supervisory training officers also runs sessions on interviewing techniques. So that they actually sit in front of a camera and watch themselves being played back, so that they have, you know, they're rather better at presenting themselves in an interview, so that if at the end of the day they don't succeed in finding a job with us, at least they are better placed to sell themselves to an employer once they leave us. Then within the company itself at large, each work experience kid is assigned to, I forget the term that Frank Bush uses, but an individual, usually in an area such as an operator training school, who generally guides those kids around the various areas. He usually has five or six different jobs with a reasonable degree of variety in a particular area, overseen by this individual who's perhaps the operator training officer in the area.
Yes.
And the kids, as necessary, are moved between those areas. And they also provide general guidance for them. But at the end of the day, Jane Bennett is the individual that they go and cry on the shoulder of, you know, when they have their personal problems, or if an individual is consistently late, or if there's some other sort of problem, where the guru in the area says, you know, can't stand this, you've got to do something, then Jane Bennett and Frank Bush will get stuck into it. And at the end of the day, they might say, you know, give you a week to pull your socks up, and if you don't, then we're just telling the Manpower Services Commission that we're pushing you out,
yes,
which happens occasionally.
Mm. And for kids on these programmes, you get government subsidy. No, we aren't paid anything.
We don't pay anything to the kids either.
That's right.
They get, I think it's £20.50 or something is the going rate, which is paid to them. But the Manpower Service Commission pays that amount to the company, and the company pays it to them.
So the kids get
a normal salaried employee.
They get a pay packet and they learn how to unpack.
That's it. So we try to treat them as if they are normal company employees.
Yes.
So they simply go and collect their pay packet in, or given it in exactly the same way as all the other employees around them.
Yes, so technically, I mean, there's there's a kind of subsidy thing, but in fact it doesn't cost.
We're just handling the money.
Yes. That's what will happen to me if I go to the Open University. I still get my pay. Still get my pay through Warwick. So do you? I mean, do you think the schemes have been useful to you?
Oh yes. I think that there's two schools of thought. Well, one school of thought says that we could have got better employees if we'd gone to the open jobs market, and the other one says, well, if you go to the open jobs market, that's fine, but you're always likely to buy a pig in a poke, because after interviewing for a half an hour or an hour, whatever it is, that's nothing like looking at them for 6 months, and you at least know what it is you're buying after you've seen them for 6 months.
Yes, it's a kind of probationary period, isn't it,
absolutely.
In that sense?
That's right.
For both sides.
That's it. I think on the whole, those who say that the work experience scheme has been a good thing and that it has benefited the company just as much as it's benefited those people who found employment are probably in the majority.
Yes. And you say the figures are roughly one third to two thirds boys to girls?
I'd say about that.
And that's fairly consistent? Over the four years or however long you've had the programme?
If anything, perhaps there were more boys in the early days. I'm not sure. I think that hasn't changed very much.
Right. And you'll go on running those programmes as long as those programmes exist as a government policy for youth unemployment.
I think my boss, the personnel director, Len Grice, is chairman or something of the local manpower services.
He's the personnel director of?
Personnel director of GEC Telecommunications.
So he's above Joan Thorpe?
Well, Joan Thorpe reports into, I think it's Tony Mocha, the staff manager.
Yes, he said that.
Reports into Roy Kenwright, who's a personnel manager, who reports into Len Grice, who's personnel director.
So he was Len Grice is personnel director, and then beneath that is?
It's the training department, there's one branch under me. The personnel department, there's another branch.
Oh, I see.
And then there's various other bits and pieces, such as a number of the maintenance areas also come under Len Grice.
And the personnel department is, then you said the hierarchy there would be there's a staff manager, and then there's Joan Thorpe.
Right.
And the staff manager's more generally overseeing them.
Yeah, staff manager in fact is my predecessor, Tony Mocha, and he has responsibility for all negotiations with staff groups in Coventry.
So that covers IR as well as recruitment then?
Yes.
In
fact, the predominant bit of his job is IR.
So he'd be the kind of head of IR?
Yes, I mean, day to day he's a lot more involved in IR than anything else, but under him are the recruitment people whom he oversees.
Yes, among whom is Joan Thorpe.
That's right.
It's terribly difficult to work out.
Yes, it is a complex organisation.
I think all are really. And presumably the manpower services kids, of course, are all full time because they have to be.
Yes, they work the normal hours of the department they're in.
Yes, so they're as much like normal.
That's it. They're treated as normal
possible.
Employees.
Yes. Have the existence of these schemes actually affected your other training schemes, or not really? I mean, they're just...
No, we in fact make sure that they are phased, that the low peer, from the point of view of the number of places required for training, but we are not recruiting out of the work experience scheme people who, or into vacancies that would otherwise be filled by our apprenticeship schemes.
Is that an agreement that you won't
do? No, it's simply that someone who comes in to the work experience scheme normally doesn't have the same sort of academic ability or qualifications that people who come into and go through our apprenticeships necessarily have.
Yes. Right, so it's a different kind. It's a different kind of training, and they'll go into, less technical,
less skilled
jobs.
That's
yes,
right.
Yes. There was one thing that I wanted to go back to, which was just because we shifted onto talking about operators. I was asking you as an example about clerical work because I was trying to find out about training schemes that existed among staff that were different from the training for the special categories whose recruitment
right.
we talked about, and I wasn't clear whether you trained clerical staff at all, other than, I mean, in the same kind of ways that you train or retrain operators, or whether it's only the instructors of clerical staff and the supervisors of clerical staff that you're doing training or retraining for.
Yes. The latter.
Long sentence,
in
sorry.
That, with operators, it's usually the case that you've got an assembly line.
Yes.
You've got lots of people doing similar types of jobs.
Yes.
Therefore, you can take them into an area and you can say, these are the skills.